Well, welcome back. We took a little time off during the holidays with our podcast, but wanted to get back started this week. Todd Stapleton, Isaac Isringhausen with our podcast, bringing it back. And a couple of topics that we're going to talk about this week. Coming up a little bit later, we're going to hit on our favorite all-time teams. So we're each going to select one that we're going to go with there. But wanted to talk a little bit about we just finished up holiday tournaments all around the area. And, you know, there's a wide variety of types of holiday tournaments. There's before Christmas, there's during Christmas, there's pool play, there's bracket play. There's probably other kinds of play. There's the pools that then turn into brackets. There's the, like, pools of three that then turn into a bracket. And anyway, and then you got El Dorado that's got 16 teams in a bracket. So there's a lot of different ways to skin the cat, I guess. I guess talking about holiday tournaments, talking about the games before, really, when we're saying holiday tournaments, I guess we're talking about all of them. But your thoughts on the kind of explosion of the holiday tournament here in the past 20 years.
I think when done right, holiday tournaments are a lot of fun. I know a couple of years back whenever South Central beat Dietrich a few years ago, and then that would have been the 22-23 season, and then Altamont in the same way. I mean, those championship games, I was at both of them, very fun atmospheres, both very regional-esque type of atmospheres. And I think one thing that those two tournaments do well is that they have a perfect combination of a good amount of teams, and it's done in, I think, 3 or 4 days. So when done right, I think they can be a lot of fun. I think it can provide some very fun, very competitive basketball, a good little mid-season test to see where you're at, a good litmus test. And also, depending on where you go and how you like who you decide to match up against, it gives you something to kind of look forward to for the postseason play, and really gives you a little bit of a test to see where you got to be at, and who you got to beat in order to kind of match up and make a deep run in the postseason.
And I kind of forgot another style is, and you brought it up, was it's got a local feel to it. And there's kind of that theory too, because you've got some tournaments that always invite in, you know, big name schools and big name players and things like that. So it becomes kind of a showcase type of thing. Centralia has had some of that over the years where they've kind of invited bigger names and bigger people in. So I don't have a issue with either style when it comes to that. I think the tournaments that invite people in have their place. That bring the big time star in, the guy that's going to Duke or on down the line. But the thing that's kind of driven me crazy since the IHSA changed the rule, and it used to be you were limited to so many tournaments and games, and it was a balance game that you played. Well, they did away with that, and they made it to where you just play 31 games. You can play as many tournaments as you want to. So then we saw an explosion of holiday tournaments. So there's a million of them going on anymore. And then so for the tournaments that have been around a long time, like a Vandalia Holiday Tournament, like a Centralia, like Carbondale, which went away completely. Carbondale's Holiday Tournament went away. Charleston had gone away before that. It makes it harder for them to keep teams in, because then it kind of has the effect of the transfer portal a little bit. You've got other places you can go. And I'll be honest, as I get older and my mindset changes on things, I don't know. I kind of think maybe we just need to leave holiday time to holiday time and let the kids have a break and let the parents have some time away from it a little bit. You know, Gary Shirley, who was the legendary coach at South Central, he always said to me that he wouldn't have them play in both a Thanksgiving tournament and a Christmas tournament because he wanted to give the families one or the other. And I thought that was a good theory, but you know, as the years go by, I kind of like the tournaments that are over with before Christmas, and the kids get a little bit of a break, and the parents get a little bit of a break, and I don't think it hurts anything. And, let's be honest, the basketball can get a little ragged when you play 3-4 days and you play a lot of games in a short period of time. And we see some crazy turnarounds in those double days too. Very short windows in between games. So I'm not against high. I'm just going to be honest. I'm not a tournament fan as I get older. And my friend Jack Bullock would really be happy to hear me say that, but I'm just not a tournament fan anymore. I've over the years, I've just, it's not the best way I enjoy watching ball. And some of them feel a little forced,
yeah,
a little bit. And I guess as the years go by, I kind of change my mind more and more. Family time is something you think more and more about as you get older, and you kind of, you know that it does. It does hamstring. There's no doubt about it. When you got a game 9:30 the morning after Christmas, it takes away from Christmas. There's no way around it. It really does. And then you play all the way up to the 30th sometimes, and you know it kind of eats into that. So I don't know. They could kind of do away with every tournament, and I'd be okay in a way. So I'm probably making somebody mad. It's just an opinion thing. So perfect tournament for you. What would you say format-wise for you be?
Me personally, I think the bracket tournament is the best. I mean, I think San Omo does it kind of perfect because, you know, you have – it's both a combination of a pool and a bracket, though, because, like, if you win one – like, for example, like, if you won on – night one on Thursday or on Tuesday, you would have a day off, then you'd play the second game on that Thursday, and then Wednesday you'd play Wednesday, Friday. So you have the combination of the pool, but you also have the bracket system as well, so you would know who exactly you're going to play. It wouldn't be a surprise. You don't have to go into the semifinal night like they do in Vandalia. It's like, well, if this scenario and this scenario, Mulberry Grove suffered from the same thing. I know they had to go down to like two or three different tiebreakers to determine who is going to be in third place and who's going to be in the championship, or fifth place and third place, my apologies. And so I think that's, I like the bracket style too, because, you know, you don't have to do as much scouting. You know who you need to watch out for, who you're going to have to worry about. And really, I feel like it takes so much more pressure off the coach's shoulders.
Yeah, I like the bracketed too. And the pool, like you said, the pool play, if things play out the way they're supposed to, it can be great. Like you talked about, the quote-unquote semifinal night at Vandalia, mm-hmm, it can be great. But if it doesn't, then you may have a complete game that just doesn't mean anything. And so I've seen both at the tournament. I've seen the night where both those two late games still meant who was getting to the championship. And then I think I've seen years where I think Greenville was already in the championship before anything went on the last day. I think everybody, so, you know, it kind of plays out. So that's the danger with pool play, is if it doesn't go the way you thought it would, then it turns out that way. So, yeah, you know, and El Dorado was one that I've followed a long time in my life. There's 16 teams in bracketed, and it's crazy. It starts, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning, goes to 11 o'clock at night for three, and they do 3 days, hammer it hard, and they're done. And I think length is another factor for a lot of people too. I think it gets past too much. It really gets long, which is funny. And that's kind of funny when you think about it. So a lot of the holiday tournaments are 3 days, like Dietrich is, mm-hmm, like El Dorado is, but then the rest of the tournaments are a week.
Right.
Thanksgiving's a week. The midwinters are a week. Nobody thinks anything of that. So it's kind of interesting. So I think we probably went as far as we can with that. But I don't know. I'm kind of one that I kind of think we ought to take a break over Christmas now. Let's let everybody have their vacation and go. And I kind of feel that way in the spring. Spring break, Easter time, let's take time off baseball and track. Let's let everybody go and do their thing. And I think we're better about that in the spring than we are in the winter sometimes. And so, you know, as you get older, I think you think more and more about family and not wanting time away from them. So you may think that way too one day. I don't know. So our other topic, and I'll let you start on this. So we were going to talk about our – and this will show an age difference, I think. Our individually our favorite teams of all time. So I'll let you start.
Before I give my official answer, a couple quick honorable mentions. Teams that I really heavily consider, the 2019 Blues were one of them. I've always been a baseball, football, basketball guy first, but in 2019, just seeing how magical the Blues run is the most invested I've probably ever have been in hockey. 2011 Cardinals barely missed out, as did the 2018 Rams, but my favorite team I think that I've seen was the 2020-2021 Illinois Fighting Illini, and for a lot of reasons, you know, when you look at the year before in 1920, that was a team that had so much potential going into the Big Ten tournament. They were the hottest team in the Big Ten. A lot of people were considering them a dark horse for the Elite Eight. Some even were saying that they could be in the Final Four. Then shortly after, you had their two best players, Io DeSumo and Kofi Coburn, both enter the transfer, or not the transfer portal, but they declare for the draft, then decide to come back, and there's just so much hype. I think they were like preseason ranked eighth, and I'm glad you really chose this topic because it forced me to kind of look back at that season and, you know, look at some of the stats. And just one thing that I forgot was how loaded the Big Ten was that year. I mean, there was a time when Illinois, Michigan, and Ohio State were ranked 2, 3, and 4 in the Big Ten. You know, that was the last year of Luka Garza and that really good Iowa team that Illinois had battles with. And just looking at the schedule too and the teams that they lost to, I mean, they went 24-7, but all seven of those losses were to really good teams. They played Baylor early. They beat Duke at Duke, which was something as a Illini fan that I never thought I'd be able to say. And it was just a fun season because, you know, Io DeSumo, who was – this is really going to show my age difference, who I think is he's the best player that I've seen in an Illinois uniform, because obviously I wasn't born for the Kendall Gill, Nick Anderson, Kenny Battle teams, and too young to remember the D Brown and Darren Williams teams. But you had Io DeSumo, who was probably the best player I've seen in an Illinois uniform. And funny enough, you and I were talking about Kofi Coburn being the most dominant player I've seen in an Illinois uniform. And I just remember going back yesterday and watching the Big Ten Tournament Championship game against Ohio State, and I think Kevin Harlan said that they beat like six teams. They won like six of the last eight in the regular season, and like four of those games were against AP top five teams. And just to see how they were able to turn the corner from what they were in the John Grosch era and the start of the Brad Underwood era, and it really, I think a big reason why that team is just so fondly in my mind is because it really helped turn them into the program that they are now.
So, what year were you born?
2000.
Okay. So, this really does show age. Definitely. So, my favorite team of all time would be the 1985 St. Louis Cardinals. And it has kind of everything for me. I was 10 years old. I had watched baseball for a while. I'd been enamored with it. 82 World Series. I was 7. I remember it, but I don't have a deep memory of it. I feel like I really started watching a lot more like the next year and the next. I remember watching the 83 World Series, when the Phillies lost to the Orioles. And then the 84 World Series when the Tigers won, and when the Cardinals, the 85 team, they were talk of baseball. They really were. Vince Coleman comes up and steals 110 bases. I mean, they kind of invented the split screen on TV, because the teams lost their minds over him. Over guys like him and Willie McGee and Ozzie Smith stealing bases. They lost their minds. I don't know if there's a better way to describe it, but they intimidated opposing teams with their speed. It truly was. It was truly an intimidation. They got on base and the pitchers lost their minds. It truly was. And they had one power bat in Jack Clark. You know, Tom Herr drives in 110 runs. Hit 8 home runs, drove in 110 runs, but he figured out I'm batting third. They're going to give me a lot to hit because the catchers wanted fastballs because Coleman and McGee were on base, and I'm going to get a lot of pitches to hit. Willie McGee had won the MVP that year. He was unbelievable. He hit 353, was probably the most exciting player on the team. that year, even with Coleman. And Coleman, like I said, pitchers lost their minds, absolutely lost their minds when it came to that team. They stole over 300 bases, which hasn't been done since, probably won't be. I mean, there's only a handful of teams that have done it all time. I can't remember how many home runs they hit, but it was well under 100 that year. They led the league in runs scored, and it was a different era. It was a different way, but it was like the perfect combination. It was like everything came together for what was known as Whitey Ball. That was the perfect year for it. And everything goes into it, because then pitching-wise, John Tudor won 21 games. He was 1-7 at one point in the season, and he ended up 21-8. He threw 10 shutouts. And that's back when people actually threw full games. So they had lost Bruce Sutter as a closer, so they had a closer by committee system. Everybody thought they were going to be – they thought they were going to be last place team. They truly thought they were going to be a last place team, and instead they win 101 games. They win the division. They get in the playoffs. They win two dramatic games in the playoffs where Ozzie Smith hits his first ever left-handed home run to win game five, game six. Jack Clark wins it. They were down 5-4 in the ninth. He hits a three-run homer. They win 7-5 to go to the series. And then things went bad. And this is why it was a life story, too, because they had the 3-1 lead in the series and then had the shot to win game six. And everybody knows about the Don Dinkinger call at first base. And then everything melted down from that point on. And here I am, 10 years old. I'm thinking, well, they'll play game seven tomorrow. Well, knowing the human frailties that I know now, they had no chance in game seven. At the time, I was a kid, though. I thought, well, they'll come out tomorrow and win, right? No, they didn't. And it was a train wreck, and it was horrible. So it kind of taught you a lot about life at 10 years old. I still will say that they ruined my childhood because of that. But so that is my favorite team. I do have some honorable mentions that you mentioned. One, mm-hmm. the 19 Blues would definitely be one for me. The 87 Cardinals would be one for me. The 04 Cardinals would be another in a different era for me, for sure. But that would be my favorite. And I'm sure you've read a little bit about it, but
absolutely.
Didn't get to see him.
Which is funny that I chuckled whenever you said that Willie McGee was the most exciting player on that team that had the best defensive shortstop ever.
Right, exactly. That's exactly right, yes. And so he was kind of overshadowed in a lot of ways that year because they had Coleman, they had McGee, they had Tommy Herrivin that year. Jack Clark actually had a little power. We didn't have a lot of those guys. And I talked about John Tudor. Well, Joaquin Andujar also won 21 games that year. Danny Cox won 18 games. They basically had three reliable starters, honestly. And then a bullpen of guys that they really had great pitchers down there, and I think every one of them could have been a closer. And then at the very end of the year, and this is reminiscent to 06, because in 06, when Jason Isringhausen went down, and Adam Wainwright took over as closer and then was a closer through the playoffs and the Cardinals won. Well, kind of the same thing happened in 85. They'd been using Jeff Lotte and Ken Daly and Rick Horton to get saves. And I know you know who Rick Horton is, mm-hmm. for sure. And then they called up Todd Worrell, and then he became the closer right at the very end and then into the playoffs. So it was kind of that was one when it happens, like, oh, okay, we've kind of been here before, you know. So it already had happened before. And that team blew exactly one lead after the eighth inning that entire year, and that was game six of the World Series. That's the only one they blew all year at eighth inning on. So it was a very, very fun ride, and I think it taught a lot about life in the end too.
Yeah, and I feel like when I look back at the Illini team in 2021 too, I mean, the big thing that you could learn there is, don't overlook anybody, because
yep.
I feel yes. like, because, you know, I felt like that team was destined to make it to the national championship. I felt like with, you know, the team that they had too, you know, you had Iota Sumo, you had Kofi Coburn, and those guys were both first team All-Americans and rightfully so, you know, they were both on like a lot of watch list. I know D'Souza was on the wooden watch list early on, and I think towards the end, Kofi was on the Kareem Abdul-Jabbar watch list. And but they also got great minutes from Trent Frazier, who was the Big Ten's Defensive Player of the Year. Andre Curbelo was the Sixth Man of the Year. And you had Damonte Williams, who was a good 3-and-D guy. Georgie Bishanas-Vili was really their only other big guy on that team that could give Kofi a break. But it was a great example of, you know, you have the two stars, but you also have these role players who can come in, play their role, and can excel in that role and not have to be all right with that and just have the – it shows that you can be a part of a winning team without having to be the superstar of it. And I think that's one thing that a lot of people can learn from is, you know, you can still contribute, recognize, but not have to have the pressure on your shoulders of being the guy.
So 21-22 with the Illini. So that would have been, they're a number one seed.
Yep.
And that's when they lost to
Loyola. That was when they lost to Loyola, yeah.
In the second round. So, yeah, that's... That absolutely kind of teaches the same kind of lesson, and that, you know, losing in that second game. And I remember sitting right here where I'm sitting, mm-hmm. and it's like early on, it's like, boy, this isn't going well. This isn't going well. And you're thinking, all right, well, they can get out of this. And then it never went well.
No.
The whole day didn't go well. So, yeah, it does. It teaches you, you know, when you go as a fan, when you – you know, the one time that I can remember crying over a game was Game 7 of the 1985 World Series. I remember it. Daryl Motley hit a home run. I believe it was Daryl Motley. Hit the home run off John Tudor. And I think that made it 5-0. Basically, game's over at that point. You know, 5 or 6-0, especially in the 80s, before your time there. But you got down 5 runs, you're done. But and it's like, that's it. We're not going to win. And that was kind of hard, you know, as a kid. That's kind of hard. And especially you're up 3-1. And then I learned the nightmare of being a Cardinal fan up 3-1. That's the worst place to be if you're a Cardinal fan ever, is the team's up 3-1. You're not winning. So I think we've won one time in my lifetime, 06 World Series.
Yep.
I think it's the only one they've won.
Yep.
Up 3. So I've set 385. Set through 96. Was it?
It was 2012. 12, yeah.
12, and they lost at 3-1. So, yeah, they're in my lifetime, they're 1-3 when they're up 3. Up 3-1. Mm-hmm. To one. They're better down 3-2 in my lifetime than up 3-1. So you do learn some life lessons at the same time. So, anything else you want to hit on?
No, I mean, I think that's one thing that, to me, makes sports so special, too, is that, you know, like you just hit on it there. You know, you can learn – I'll say this, and I don't care who I say this to. I don't care if this offends anybody. You learn more life lessons from playing sports than I think you can sitting in a classroom and reading a textbook. And I think that's one reason why everyone should at least try to be involved in sports in some sort of way, because, you know, you learn different aspects of how to handle failure, how to set and achieve goals, how to work as a team. And I think that's one thing that is going to help you out so much more in life than reading a textbook will, in my opinion.
You know, I agree with you very much. It brings me back to something I saw a video of on social media. So during the COVID, we saw a lot of older games brought back, and one that got brought back was the 92 regional finals between Duke and Kentucky, mm-hmm. when Christian Laettner hits the turnaround shot to win it. And growing up where I did, there were a lot of Kentucky fans. Not a fun place, but there was a lot of them wandering around. They've went away now, I think. But so I remember the next day at school, and I was a junior in high school, and I remember the next day listening to all of them moan and whine, and I had one friend that swore up and down that Laettner didn't get the shot off on time. I'm like, dude, watch the video. There's no question. But anyway, so during COVID, that game got replayed. In fact, it had a primetime period where they brought it back. And I remember watching this video, and it was two twins. I think they were twins. They're probably 8 or 9. And they sat with their folks and watched the game. And when Laettner hits the shot, they turn to their mom and they're like, "We lost? That was it?" "Yep, that was it." And just the stunned look on their faces that night, because it's like they just learned a lesson, you know. They just learned a lesson about losing, and you gotta learn how to lose. Mm-hmm. You gotta learn how to lose. You gotta, as a fan, you gotta learn. You also had to remember that all that trash you were talking to your buddy that was a Duke fan or a Kentucky fan or whoever. Now you've got it coming back to you. That's why I'm a little careful about what I say sometimes, because you don't want to listen to it coming back the other way. So. And then being a Blues fan for most of my life, you never talk trash because you know it's coming back. So no, I agree. I think sports teaches a lot of lessons, and it teaches you how to compete more mm-hmm. than anything. But I think it teaches you how to accept failure, because you're going to fail. If you're out there competing and you're playing hard, you're going to fail, and you're going to have to go through some of those. And so 85 kind of has a big combo with me on a lot of things. So, well, I think that's going to wrap us up for the week. As we've said a couple times, we love to get suggestions on topics for the program. You can email me, Todd Stapleton, 1071@gmail.com. You can message one of our Facebook pages too. We'll be back next week with another edition of our podcast. For Isaac Isringhausen, I'm Todd Stapleton.